This is the Jon Favreau's My Daddy podcast with Jessica Garcia and Monica Montoya. Did the intro scare you a little bit,
Monica? The intro freaked me the fuck out. It was like, and I was like, I saw my life flash before my eyes, all eight of them.
Yeah, but then you were reassured when my really soothing voice came on.
Yeah, this is the Jon Favreau. I don't even know how to say
it. Great impression of me. I wish my voice sounded like that all the time.
It doesn't.
It does not. It's a special voice to put on.
I'm the annoying one. I'm the one with the annoying voice. You have the soothing, sultry voice of a million stars.
I've been told I have a soothing voice. I'm on another podcast called All in My Head that I play a therapist on. And they hired me because they're like, you have the most soothing voice. It sounds like it should be like ASMR. And I was like, nah, I disagree. I think my voice is annoying.
Should we do ASMR?
ASMR daddy.
ASMR daddy. It's when we're just so.
It's where I say the word Jon Favreau 1,000 times.
Jon
Favreau.
Happy Hogan.
Anyway, hello. Welcome.
Welcome.
Welcome to this week.
This is a very special episode.
This is a special episode.
This is our audio guy, Aaron's. Mm-hmm. Birthday episode.
Monica's husband, my friend, our audio guy.
Sorry.
Aaron. It's his birthday today.
It's his birthday. Well,
it's not while we're recording. It is the exact day it comes out, though.
Yeah, so today on December 8th, it is his birthday. Wah, wah.
Happy birthday.
Happy.
How old are you
going to
be, Aaron? You're 26, right? 26. What an old man.
Happy birthday to you. Happy, 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 happy birthday to you. I'm going to throw in a little remix in there.
Exactly. So we asked Aaron.
We let him choose.
We asked him what daddy he would like this week to be about. And he chose
Aaron Sorkin.
Aaron Sorkin. Same name.
Same name.
Different person.
Different careers. Different levels of success.
What are you talking? You're not married to someone as famous as Aaron Sorkin?
No, I'm not.
What?
Aaron Sorkin is he writes things.
He does write things. We love when he writes things. We don't love when he directs things. We'll share our thoughts on that.
We'll give you some context.
Exactly. But I love Aaron Sorkin as a writer. He has
so
written
good.
He wrote one of my top two fave shows ever, which is The Newsroom.
I was gonna say The West Wing.
I've only seen a season, but boy, did I love that season.
Boy, did I love that season of The West Wing.
It's just such a long show, and it's all about the president and politics.
The president.
I just can't watch it all the time.
Politics. I just can't bring myself to watch it unless I'm drunk. And I don't get drunk very often. I don't watch it.
You sound like Moaning Myrtle.
I know. Harry Potter, you don't come into the bathroom without asking me. I'm peeing. I'm going number one, not number two. Harry, pay attention to me. So this has turned into an Harry Potter impressions podcast.
Anyway, back to Aaron Sorkin.
Anyway, Dumbledore.
Aaron Sorkin. My favorite writer of all time. Better than Harry Potter. Who? Harry? No.
Oh, this is my favorite bit we've ever done.
Oh, this is good. This is good. Aaron Sorkin. Tell us a little bit about him.
I will tell you about him. Okay. Aaron Sorkin is an American screenwriter, director, producer, and playwright. Sorkin was born in Manhattan and grew up in Scarsdale. He graduated from Syracuse University in 1983 with a BFA in musical theater, which is very surprising.
So, what?
I don't think of Aaron Sorkin as a musicale man, but he loves that. He loves the musicale.
Everyone close your eyes and picture Aaron Sorkin. Like, you know what he looks like.
In, like, Oklahoma.
In, like, Oklahoma, or, like, even worse, like,
in Dear Evan Hansen as Evan Hansen. It's me, Aaron.
It's me.
I'm a star, baby, a star.
But anyway, so he got a BFA in musical theater and pursued acting for some time, supporting himself by delivering singing telegrams. Can you imagine getting a singing fucking telegram from Aaron Sorkin? I'd drop dead. I don't know about you.
I would pass away.
I don't know if I would realize at first that it's him, because I do know what he looks like, but I think I would be so just like, it can't be Aaron Sorkin.
Aaron Sorkin has a big ass mouth.
He got a big ass mouth. That's great for singing.
That's great for singing.
Lots of resonance in there.
He sings a song. And he sings along.
So anyway, to support himself while trying to be an actor, he delivered singing telegrams, he drove limos, and he bartended at the Palace Theater.
Wow.
Sorkin began writing while house-sitting for a friend. He found a typewriter, started typing, and the rest is history.
Is it, though? I don't know that it is. I think it's present times.
Yes. After writing only two plays, Sorkin got a theatrical agent and then wrote A Few Good Men, for which he sold the film rights before the play even premiered. What a fucking joke.
Okay, everyone just needs to pause for a second. This doesn't happen. This never happens. You don't just write two plays and then become incredibly rich and famous. That's not what happened. I work in theater, everyone.
This is the same world of the Something's Gotta Give, Erica Berry being a really, really, like, millionaire playwright.
This is,
playwright.
Like, the same universe.
This shit doesn't...
Doesn't happen.
It's not true. Aaron Sorkin is lying.
Aaron Sorkin is false.
I don't think he's lying, but, you know...
We're just jealous. That's really what it is.
But since then, he has gained fame for creating and writing popular TV shows such as Sports Night, The West Wing, and The Newsroom, as well as feature films, and developing his director trademarks, the main one being fast-paced dialogue and extended monologues, complemented by the storytelling technique, the walk-in talk.
The walk-in talk.
Which, if you don't know what that is, I will tell you. It consists of single tracking shots of long duration involving multiple characters conversing while they walk, with other characters entering and exiting the conversation as the shot continues.
If that was confusing, it's because it is. It's just walking and fucking talking.
And I shouldn't have said it's just director trademarks. They're also writing trademarks of his. He has won 5 Emmys, 2 Golden Globes, 1 BAFTA, and 1 Academy Award. He is also the literal daddy to 1 single daughter.
A single daughter who gets all of the cake and the cookies and the love and the ponies. It's just me.
Daddy, I want a pony.
Daddy, I want you to write me a play and make it so.
I'll do it for you.
Daddy, I want Tom Cruise to take me to the prom.
Daddy, you know Tom Cruise. Have him take me to the prom.
Please call him Daddy. Please.
I'm very sorry if this is insulting to Aaron Sorkin's daughter.
We love you, Aaron Sorkin's daughter. We have no idea who you are.
I think her name is Roxy.
Roxy Hart.
Can you imagine if Aaron Sorkin loved musical theater so much, he named his daughter after Roxy? A character from Chicago?
Chicago,
I mean,
no.
It's possible. This theory is not unfounded. Let's get into his films, shall we?
We shall.
So this is the big one.
We're going to start with the number one. We're going to start with the one that came out of the typewriter. Yeah. Okay? We're going to start with numero uno, the one that came out of the Corona typewriter.
Not.
By the way.
Because it was in 1992.
Okay. Probably the electronic typewriter. which, by the way, if you like typewriters, Tom Hanks has a typewriter app called Hanks. Hanks Writer.
Hanks.
Hanks with an X.
Hanks.
H-A-N-X.
Thanks, Hanks.
Thanks, Hanks. A Few Good Men came out in 1992, as Jessica so cleverly stated.
I'm sorry, I ruined it for you.
Written by Juan Aaron Sorkin.
Surprise.
Of Dumbledore fame. Directed by Rob Reiner.
Again. You know, you see two different sides of Rob here as a director.
You saw him in When Harry Met Sally, and you see him in A Few Good Men.
Yes, the duality of man.
The duality of man. Based on the play by Aaron Sorkin, and a little bit about it. Lieutenant Dan, played by Tom Cruise.
Okay, say his real name.
Sorry, it was right there. Lieutenant Daniel Caffey, played by Tom Cruise, is a military lawyer defending two U.S. Marines charged with killing a fellow Marine at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. Although Caffey is known for seeking plea bargains, a fellow lawyer, Lieutenant Commander Joanne Galloway, played by Demi Moore, convinces him that the accused Marines were most likely carrying out an order from a commanding officer. Caffey takes a risk by calling Colonel Nathan R. Jessup, played by Jack Nicholson, to the stand in an effort to uncover the conspiracy.
Yes, yes, yes. Even if you haven't seen this movie, you know the iconic lines.
You can't handle the truth!
That's the one.
That's the one.
That's the one. The iconic line.
It is in the movie. It is so
the things have just like escalated to such a point
where he has to say it. He has no like. He's legally obligated to say you can't handle the truth.
Well, the thing is I think because you and I in 2020 seeing this film for the first time. Mm-hmm. We've already heard that line a million times so, without actually seeing the source material. It came from this movie.
I know.
So at the time, it was a super fucking clever line.
So when it comes out of Jack Nicholson's mouth, yeah. It seems really insincere because that line is so cheesy. Mm-hmm. Coming from us to Heeman in 2020.
Yeah.
Who have heard You Can't Handle the Truth about... 3 billion trillion yeah. times, all in different contexts.
Yep.
So coming out of Jack Nicholson's mouth in that way, I laughed out loud.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, Lord.
He was like, you can't do that.
But it became iconic for a reason, because it's an iconic line.
It's iconic.
You know, it's a good line. Well done, Aaron Sorkin.
Well done, Aaron. Good job, Aaron.
So this is Aaron Sorkin's first screenplay.
His first screenplay.
Which, very impressive for a screenplay.
It, you know what's so funny is I enjoyed it because it felt a lot like a play.
Mm-hmm.
And
go figure, because it
came from a play. I obviously the dialogue was fucking stunning. I mean, people don't fucking talk like that.
No.
It be what it
they
be.
They don't. They don't. But that's not his bag.
That's not his vibe. That's not his MO is not to be like quote unquote relatable. His vibe, his MO is to be as godlike as humanly possible.
Exactly.
And I really enjoyed it. I mean, I obviously am not a big like military movie fan.
Same.
But I enjoyed this film. I think that it had its weaknesses.
Yeah.
In that it did a lot of telling and not showing. It sort of like told you what was happening as it was happening.
Yeah.
And the characters were like, this is happening right now. And then I'm going to tell you what happened after it happened.
This movie doesn't treat the audience like they're very smart.
Yes.
Or like it loses a lot of the joy that comes in watching a movie where you get to figure shit out yeah. and you get to like assume things and deduce.
It doesn't hold a lot of tension that way. It mm-hmm. holds tension in other ways.
Yeah.
But it doesn't hold a lot of tension in the quote unquote unknown. Because it doesn't do, sorry, Aaron, it doesn't do a very good job of, you know, trusting the audience and saying mm-hmm. you guys got this, we don't have to explain it, you guys can see on the screen what's happening.
Yes.
They don't trust the audience at all.
It is a pretty complex story, just because there's a lot of fucking names, there's a lot of titles,
there's a lot
getting
of names.
Thrown around,
there's a lot of, which I found very confusing, a lot of like ranks, which yes. obviously if you're a part of a military family, my brother's in the Army and it didn't seem this complicated. And specifically the Marine Corps, it's like a big ass deal.
Yeah.
And there's just a lot of like different ranks and like different ranks within the ranks, and it's like it's so bizarre. And I think that being led into this world, mm-hmm. As I have to be honest, I definitely had to read, like pause the movie and like look up what each of the ranks meant.
Sure.
And like why certain people were in the rank that they were in, mm-hmm. and like what a platoon leader, what, like I was that bitch. Like I was sure. the bitch that was like, I need to pause and like look this up so I can have a little bit of context. But other than that, like it was very in your face about like who was who and like why, like what their intentions mm-hmm. were and like why they were who they were. Which I sound like I'm contradicting myself because I'm like, I had to look it up, but I also don't want to know. Well, I don't want to know that much information.
The thing is like Aaron Sorkin can't tell you everything you need to know. He can't like define the terms for you.
No.
But he can spell out the story. So like, I guess because Monica and I like kind of the energy when you're watching a movie of trying to figure shit out. Mm-hmm. That's why this script felt, I don't want to say it fell short because it didn't. It just like wasn't the Aaron Sorkin that I was used to. Because he tells a little bit, he gives a little bit too much information, but I think he did that because he understood that it is a very complex issue and it's existing in a very complex system of the Marines. Yes. And so he wanted to give you as little gray area as possible.
I think that I had my biggest, again, like that was my biggest issue with it. I mm-hmm. think the reason I had it is because I came into it knowing it came from a play. Fucking adore that. I love plays. It makes me want to watch the play, which mm-hmm. by the way, they're doing like a live retelling of the play on HBO soon. It's very, very exciting, which is why we couldn't find it anywhere. We had to buy the fucking movie to watch
this. I have
a
really great story about my pursuit of buying this that Monica, you don't know the story.
I haven't told you. You can tell us in a second. Oh, but I basically, I can see how on stage this would have translated perfectly because on stage you have very little to work with, especially in 1992. Mm-hmm. You have very little to work with technically, and also being that it's not a very visual medium. Mm-mm. Like you don't necessarily like the majority of what you use to communicate on stage with is words and like feeling, mm-hmm. right? Like the acting.
Yeah.
And I think that this would have translated, obviously probably did. I'm acting like, oh, like when it's a play, this is what it should be.
But it already is a play.
And I think that what I imagine the play, why the play worked so well mm-hmm. is because a lot of this dialogue is very explanatory. And in a play, you have to have that kind of dialogue, especially during this time, especially if it's a linear play. Mm-hmm. And even more so if it is a non-linear play.
Yeah, exactly.
And I just think, I think in that way, I appreciate it. I don't necessarily think that it needed to be this way as a film because it's a very visual storytelling mm-hmm. medium. So I just don't see how, I just think you could have dropped a few pages. I really do.
Yeah, I agree. The only thing is like, because, so Aaron Sorkin has a very distinct style, and this gets into like what I love about Aaron mm-hmm. Sorkin. Everything is like very fast and very snappy, and like his
pretty
scripts
sexy.
Are very like active and they're yes. very alive. And so I think when things are moving that quickly, in a way it feels like you're helping. I can see how from his perspective he would think he is helping the audience by including a lot of information mm-hmm. because he's like, it's going so fast already and it's gotta go fast because that's my style mm-hmm. but I don't want them to miss anything. It's like, I understand where he's coming from.
Absolutely.
I think it took away a little bit of my like joy of suspense
mm-hmm. Intention.
But besides that, I loved it. There are some, obviously we said it already, like iconic moments in mm-hmm. this film that you've seen.
I do want to talk about like the moments that we feel like it's the most Sorkin-y mm-hmm. Because the movie as a whole felt very un-Sorkin-y, and it had moments where he sort of peeked through the most that I really appreciated.
Yeah, the like, Sorkin we know now.
Yes.
Because obviously this was the world's first intro.
Exactly. The Sorkinese wasn't 100% there.
Yeah.
So I think that one of the moments that stood out to me that I was like, oh, this is an Aaron Sorkin film, is when Tom Cruise, who plays Kathy, mm-hmm. was super, like, he was, like, getting shwasted and, like, yelling yeah. at Demi Moore and what's-his-face, 13
Kevin
Jews.
Kevin Pollak.
Yes, which, by the way, I wasn't saying he was yelling at 13 Jews. I was saying that what's-his-face plays Mr. Maisel in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and he has a story where he's like,
Kevin Pollak,
I saved 13 Jews from Germany. What the fuck did you do, Tony Shalhoub? So, just saying. But it peeks through in that little monologue. He has like a very...
Yeah, he just starts, screaming and talking so fast and ends it with some sort of statement about like the galactically stupid.
I know, which is so Aaron Sorkin.
Insane line. And then he throws papers off the table.
Which is
and
also
just like,
so Aaron Sorkin.
Oh, boy. The thing is, though, is that like... they see these moments seem so extreme, but like honestly, what a fucking dream as an actor. Because even though they're so wordy and they're so fast, it comes back to that like cliche but very true concept behind acting of acting is reacting. Mm-hmm. And these are the most reactive pieces of dialogues ever.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine being an actor and being handed an Aaron Sorkin script and saying like go? Like that's crazy.
Crazy.
To me.
Like there's what just so much to do with it.
What a dream.
There's so many directions for it to go. The words are insane, but there's also so many of them. So there's just like you can be so creative with it. You're not put into those situations as an actor where you have a 3-word line.
And I love you.
They're like, do something different with it. And you're just like,
what?
What? What else is there?
This pot is heavy. This pot is heavy.
No, Monica, say it like you're scared of the pot.
This pot is heavy.
Aaron Sorkin doesn't put you in that position.
No, he doesn't. He goes, this pot is heavy because it's big, it's black, it holds so much, and it's a galactic fucking mistake that you fucked this up and bought this fucking pot. And that's Aaron Sorkin.
Yes, exactly. The content of this movie, so Aaron Sorkin is really interested in government, politics, the military,
law.
He fucking loves this shit.
He gets a big hard on for like the courtroom drama. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. And this is his first. So this is like his big courtroom drama.
He was a courtroom drama virgin before he wrote this.
Yeah, exactly. He makes me care about those things, I think, as much as a filmmaker can make me care about those things.
I was going to say, it's not a...
I'm not going to say I don't care about politics, but I don't give a shit about, like, the military's definition of honor.
Right.
You know, that's very hard for me to understand and get behind, and I think Aaron Sorkin got me about as close as I could get to, like, really grasping that.
Absolutely.
Because that's just not something that I really like agree with.
I think a lot of this movie is okay. Everyone has a very different opinion about whether or not this movie is pro or anti-military. Yes. I honestly think it's anti-military. I don't see anywhere in this movie where like the military is a positive force in anyone's life. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always thought that being in the military is supposed to, you know, make you humble. It's supposed to like, bring you a sense of humility, like one out of many, right? Mm-hmm. Like I am one of many. And a lot about this movie is the sense of entitlement that being in the military gives you, like almost like you are better than. So you are better than the many. You are one out of many. And I just think that telling that kind of story and painting a very specific picture of the military that holds a lot of truth, honestly, like a lot of people abuse that system.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people think that that's okay, that they have... They are entitled to abuse that system because they are the ones who are protecting us at night.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that that's, I don't think that that's a good enough reason to have that sense of entitlement. I really, really
Neither
don't.
Neither do I.
And I think that this movie plays around with that idea. Mm-hmm. And obviously Aaron Sorkin has a very specific opinion about it as a whole. I just think people in general take very different ideas from this film. And I think it's an anti-military film.
Yeah, because if you haven't seen this movie and you don't intend to watch it, or even if you do, whatever, Tom Cruise and Demi Moore are defending the two Marines who killed a man.
Murdered a man.
They did it, quote unquote, accidentally because they were just following orders that were given to them. You eventually find out by Jack Nicholson. And so Tom Cruise is defending them and being like, no, they were told to do it. They were just following orders. Mm-hmm. And Kevin Bacon beautifully is the prosecutor.
Oh my God.
And he's like, no, these men still committed murder. And the whole time, I think you're supposed to be on the side of Tom Cruise and Demi Moore, but I was like, no, Kevin Bacon is right.
Yeah.
Like, these dudes committed murder. I don't care if someone told them to do it. But then you kind of, you're told that like within the military, things work a lot differently
than in, like, quote unquote real life.
Yeah, that, like, if you're given an order, you fucking follow that order,
or someone dies
or you get kicked out or whatever, and you find out at the very end that apparently being dishonorably discharged is about the worst thing that can fucking happen.
It's worse than going to jail for the rest of your life.
It's worse than dying. It's worse than lying about your guilt. It's the absolute worst thing that can ever happen to you. And I find it very hard to buy into that entire concept, because the whole time I was just like, no, Kevin Bacon is right. These men, Jack Nicholson deserves to go to prison, but so do these other fuckers.
Absolutely. I think that within the military specifically, and a big comment that this film is trying to make is, like, the military works very differently than quote unquote real life, right?
Yeah.
It's a very different world. Like, these are men and women and people who are protecting our borders and protecting our livelihoods and lives and what have you, and protecting our freedom, right? Mm-hmm. And because of that, because of their, you know, ultimate sacrifice, they are operating on a very different wavelength. Like, they're operating in a different world, on a different planet.
Yeah, there's, like, a different code of ethics.
Absolutely. There's a completely different code of ethics. Everyone is entitled to their own opinion. I don't think that that is warranted. I don't believe that just, you know, having that, opportunity and being that person, like someone who, you know, lays down their life for someone else, or someone who makes the ultimate sacrifice and is like, no, I'm going to give my life to the military. Like, absolutely. Like, you know, we honor them and are grateful for, you know, our military for protecting our nation. Sure. I don't know how that lets you get away with, like, murder of your own people.
No.
Like, and I don't get that.
The thing is that Aaron Sorkin makes you think about both sides. And I did find moments where I was like, maybe they should be innocent. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Which, like, it takes a good writer to get you to that point where you're questioning both sides. And I would say that you can't really tell what side Aaron Sorkin himself is on.
Exactly.
Which is good. You are given so many different angles on this entire argument. And in a way, I'm like, it seems like, oh, Aaron Sorkin believes that these men are murderers, because he ends the story with them being dishonorably discharged. And he recognizes that for them, that's, like, worse than death.
Absolutely.
So he is giving them the consequences that they deserve in a way.
I guess I just think that I love that we're even having this conversation, or that this screenplay even opens up these kinds of conversations, because that's what makes a good screenplay.
Yes, that's how you know it's a good movie.
Well, that's how you know it's a good play, too, is when you leave the theater being like, you know, it's a lot more complicated than just black and white.
Yes.
And Aaron Sorkin is the king of gray. Like, he's the king of that gray area of the... was this okay? Did we want to root for this guy? Did we not want to root for this guy?
Yes, moral ambiguity is something he does impeccably.
His name is Aaron Moral Ambiguity Sorkin. That's his name. And with this specific film, you can see, like, obviously glimpses of what he will eventually become. his evolution, his Aaron 2. And you start to see, like, glimpses of who he's going to be as a writer.
Yeah.
And I think this being your, like, first screenplay, like, holy shit. Like, this is crazy.
I'm pretty sure this is the movie he won his Oscar for, if I'm not mistaken. Or no, it was for The Social Network, I think, actually.
The Social Network.
But he was nominated for this, and that's insane. He wrote two plays, and then this happened.
It's like that, you have to... Then you start to think about, well, you know, there's the whole argument of, like, hard work versus talent.
Sure.
And I just think the man is fucking talented.
I have no doubt that Aaron Sorkin would have put in the hard work, though, if he hadn't lucked out with, because, like, someone saw the play, or someone, like, read it beforehand who happened to be connected in Hollywood. Like, it was a matter of luck. But I believe that Aaron Sorkin would have, you know, powered through, did some fucking hard work. I think it's a really good movie, especially if you like Aaron Sorkin. Like, I love Aaron Sorkin. He's one of my favorite writers, and yet I had never seen A Few Good Men.
That's so funny. Yeah.
So it's really interesting.
Jessica and I both feel the exact same way about Aaron Sorkin. His writing is just so alive, and, like, it makes you, like, I never have to have, like, a Coke when I am watching his films. Because his script gives me the energy to, like, stay awake and alert throughout the entire fucking film. Which, by the way, I'm notorious for falling asleep during films. So that's why I'm even mentioning this. But A Few Good Men was a very pleasant experience and a very interesting look. As, you know, obviously, like, neither one of us has ever seen his first film. And, like, it was really cool and interesting to, like, come from a place of, like, we've seen his much later works and coming back to his very earliest work.
Yeah.
Very interesting, very cool. Like, I found myself kind of smiling, being like, that's sort of, like, where he's going to, like, blossom and flower into the butterfly that he is. The butterfly with the round glasses that he is.
And now we both own the fucking movie, so
I know, and now we both own, which, by the way, you have to tell us before we move on.
Okay.
How you came to own this movie.
We tried doing, like, recording this episode prior to this, but A Few Good Men was not available literally anywhere. You could only buy it for like $12.99. And Monica and I were like, is an episode, a single episode, worth $12.99? I don't think so. So we decided to watch The Trial of the Chicago 7 instead. After watching it, we were like, we cannot do an Aaron Sorkin episode without doing A Few Good Men. It's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I went on Amazon and I found a DVD of it for $7.99. Great. Cheap enough for me. I ordered it. I was like, cool, I'm going to come back from my trip. I'm going to watch it as soon as I get back. So I get back. I don't have a DVD player, but I do have like a disc drive that plugs in. But you know how fucking Apple doesn't have USB ports on anything anymore? And I couldn't find the fucking adapter. So I'm sitting in my house going, okay. So I have this DVD that I purchased specifically for this occasion. Of course, so I didn't have to spend $12.99 on it. What the fuck am I going to do? And then I'm like, I'm going to have to buy the movie again.
No.
So I go on the television, Monica. The price, it's still there, but the price has been reduced to, guess what? $7.99, the fucking price I conceded to purchase it for in the first place. So now I have bought it twice.
Oh my God.
Both for $7.99. I could have just spent $12.99 initially and still profited.
Still spent less. You are insane. The movie gods do not look favorably upon you.
I think I'm going to try and return the DVD, but like, I opened it and everything already. I don't know if I can.
I think you're just going to have to be the guy who owns.
I think I might just have to be the person who owns a physical and a digital copy of A Few Good Men.
Even though you had only ever seen it once very recently.
Yep.
It's like, I don't even know that it's like, did it end up making it into like your top 20 favorite like movies of all time?
No.
No.
I mean, I liked it, but I'm not good. A courtroom drama is not going to make it into my top 20 films.
No.
So joke's on me, I guess. That was Aaron Sorkin's little prank for me.
You are so funny. Oh my God.
That'll be featured on my next podcast, Pranked by Aaron Sorkin.
Pranked by A.S. Aaron Sorkin.
All right, guys. Moving on to our second film, The Social Network.
The Social Net.
You've all probably, of the three we're going to talk about, I think you've all probably seen this movie.
If you have seen an Aaron Sorkin movie, this is probably the movie that you've seen.
Yeah.
Whether or not you realized it was an Aaron Sorkin yeah, movie.
Which I don't know how you couldn't. It has all the markers.
Exactly. It was directed by David Fincher. Mm-hmm. It features a very like smart and isolated and also like above everyone else.
Yep.
Your main character.
Yep.
It's got snappy dialogue.
Yep.
It's got, you know, a lovely contrast between mm-hmm. the good and the bad, mm-hmm. the moral mm-hmm. ambiguity. Mm-hmm. It's got it all, baby.
Got it all.
It's got the talk and walk. We've got it all.
All right. So this is The Social Network 2010, directed by David Fincher, as Monica said, written by Aaron Sorkin, based on the book Accidental Billionaires by Ben Mezrich. In 2003, Harvard undergrad and computer genius Mark Zuckerberg, played by Jesse Eisenberg, begins work on a new concept that eventually turns into the global social network known as Facebook. 6 years later, he is one of the youngest billionaires ever, but Zuckerberg finds that his unprecedented success leads to both personal and legal complications when he ends up on the receiving end of two lawsuits, one involving his former best friend and Facebook co-founder Eduardo Saverin, played by Andrew Garfield. What a film. This movie is in my top 20 favorite movies ever.
This is, 100%. First of all, this movie. So, like, there are really fucking good movies in the world, and they're like perfect movies, and there are movies that where you're like, wow, mm-hmm. like I can't really find a lot wrong with that movie.
Yeah.
No movie, I don't know that any movie is like perfection. No. There's always something wrong. Humans are humans, and when humans make art, they make mistakes.
Also because art is subjective, so.
Peace of mind. I think specifically The Social Network is like a fucking triumph. I think it yeah. does exactly what it was supposed to do. And I think that if you're measuring on a level of success in mm-hmm. terms of like how it tells its story and where it gets from point A to point B, this is a perfect movie in my opinion.
Yeah, this movie is invigorating. Like you feel fucking alive yes. watching this movie.
Absolutely.
And like it's based on a true story. It's about fucking tech, which I am not interested in.
I'm not interested in Silicon Valley. However,
this movie, oh my God. I can watch this movie over and over again and still find it interesting and be excited for all of the parts that I know are coming.
I've seen this movie a million times. Yeah, I've seen this movie a million times.
This is a movie I do own on DVD.
This movie you want to own on DVD. This is a movie
I went out and bought on DVD.
Starting with sort of just like the outline of the film, I think that the film's structure is impeccable.
Yes.
I love all of the beats in the film. I love where we're at. Like, I love how tight Act One is. Mm-hmm. Like, I love a tight Act One.
Oh, it's a tight
Act One. It is a tight Act One. She keeps it tight. It's a tight Act One. Like, yes, honey, give it to me. I love a good. The Act One in this film is like the time and the pacing of the Act One in this film is the Act One I want all films to have.
Yeah. Also, this is one of the most perfect marriages between film and score I've yes. ever seen. The score in this movie, like I drool over the score.
Who's the composer?
In this movie. It's Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. That's who it
Trent
is.
Trent and Addie Baby.
It's so good. I also bought the album of this score on iTunes after I saw this movie. So you know I really like it.
First of all, this movie was fucking lightning in a bottle because you don't necessarily have a lot of people, attacking the story mm-hmm. of Facebook and also attacking the story of Mark Zuckerberg as a human being.
Yes.
Who is he? What are his morals? Why does he do things? Like, no one at that point in time had been like, yo, like, let's do this biopic. Mm-hmm. Of Mark Zuckerberg specifically at this point in time and specifically as he is facing legal charges
yeah.
for as he's being sued for taking Facebook over mm-hmm. and like becoming like the sole proprietor of Facebook or like yes. the main shareholder mm-hmm. Along with a hilarious Justin Timberlake.
Hilarious Justin Timberlake as Sean, what's his name, who founded Napster?
Sean Parker.
Sean Parker.
He founded Napster. And he is just fucking insane. And
he's an absolutely insane
person.
He
is the one who gives the iconic line in the film where he's like,
Drop the.
Just Facebook.
It's like, cleaner.
And then just saunters
and
away.
Just walks the fuck away.
Struts away. And Jesse Eisenberg was playing Mark Zuckerberg is just sitting there like,
what?
All right, I just got shot.
This movie, okay, so Aaron Sorkin, we said it when we were talking about A Few Good Men, but like his signature is this quick, snappy, like witty dialogue. It feels like a fucking ping pong match. Like, it's crazy. He's so good at writing this crazy, complicated, fast dialogue and like strapping you into that roller coaster. But he does it in a way where like everything is weirdly clear.
Yes.
So you're just like, I'm on board.
A few actors I think can keep up with that pace. Mm-hmm. Tom Cruise in A Few Good Men tried his best. I don't think he was entirely successful.
I think he did relatively well, but yeah.
But Jesse fucking Eisenberg was made. Like, he was
incredible.
He was born to speak the words of one Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, there are actors that are like, when you marry them with an Aaron Sorkin film, they mm-hmm. like shine. They like, I had never really at that point in time consider Jesse Eisenberg to be like an actor?
I didn't really know like anything about him. Like, I knew he did The Squid and the Whale, mm-hmm. which I think was pre-2010. Yeah, so I had known that he was in that movie. I hadn't seen that movie, but this is the movie that put Jesse Eisenberg on everyone's fucking map.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. 100%. He is so incredibly like focused and also so funny in the most like unintentional way.
Yeah,
but obviously it's intentional on his end. It just comes through as completely like accidental. Yeah. And it is so yummy. Like I adore his performance in this film.
Well, like when he has that opening conversation with Rooney Mara, mm-hmm. who this is another early role for her, and so she's only in it briefly, but she's really good in it. They're having an argument and then she breaks up with him. Mm-hmm. And she says dating you was like dating a stairmaster, which is so fucking funny because I imagine that's what it's like to be with Aaron Sorkin as well.
I agree.
They just seem like kindred spirits, him and Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah. Which is so funny. Aaron Sorkin is attracted to like really smart and mm-hmm. very obviously morally ambiguous and also just very like go, go, go people.
Yes.
That are like kind of giants in their world. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, obviously we're not talking about Moneyball now, but like with Moneyball, with Molly's Game, with Steve fucking Jobs, like with The Social Network, he's attracted to like people who think really outside of the box and are oftentimes like... they oftentimes like pay for it. Like it's often yeah. a challenge in their life. It is both a challenge and a triumph to be who they are. And I think that that's who he's attracted to the most because I think that he's very similar to that. Like
yeah.
what his assets are also his faults. And I think that that really shines throughout all of his screenplays.
Yeah. And that's obviously why he's so attracted to like these giants in like law and military and politics and tech, because those are those types of personalities, like you said. And it just, oh god, they just mesh so,
it's like
beautifully together,
perfect harmony. Yeah. Like there are people who make movies and they pick people to work on those movies and it doesn't always work out the way that you want it mm-hmm. to, and the end result is kind of like a mishmash of like, you know, this was good, but this wasn't really good. Yeah. But I'll, you know, we call it like forgiving a film for sure. being a certain way. Like, oh, I'll forgive the writing because, oh, the directing was so good.
Exactly.
Or like, I'll forgive the score because the writing was so good. In The Social Network, there is no forgiving. Like, mm-hmm. all of the things exist to only uplift the other thing.
Yeah. You can tell how intentional everything in this movie is. And obviously, a lot of that is due to David Fincher and a lot to the actors as well, mm-hmm. but they need material to fucking work with.
Absolutely.
And Aaron Sorkin brought it. He's so hyper aware of exactly how fast he's moving. And he recognizes it and almost kind of looks at the audience and is like, but we're going to go faster.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so smart. It feels like you're on drugs when you're watching this movie.
Contrasting with A Few Good Men, he actually trusts you as the audience member to be on his wavelength.
Yeah.
Which obviously was missing from A Few Good Men, but he snaps that right fucking up in The Social Network.
Yeah, because like, this is a complicated movie.
It's very complicated, but the moving pieces, and this obviously has a lot to do with the director being incredible. David Fincher is fucking incredible at telling fast-paced mm-hmm. stories and making them very, very clear to the audience, a lot of showing and not telling. Mm-hmm. But with Aaron Sorkin's writing, he ups the voltage with every act.
Yeah.
And you are prepared as the audience member to go along that ride and you don't lose the momentum.
Yeah.
Like you understand, like he sets up all of the pieces and all the beats in the film and all of the dialogue is obviously like snappy, witty, crazy. And you are, as the audience member, equipped for that.
Yeah.
So when you get to the end, you feel like you've run a marathon with the movie versus in order to catch up with the movie.
Yeah. But at the same time, he's managed to keep you engaged enough to still feel for the characters that are otherwise shitty.
Yes.
And still find the points of relatability, because like, I can't fucking relate to a lawsuit over billions of dollars regarding creating fucking Facebook. There's nothing relatable about that, but there is something relatable about losing a friendship and having business and friendship destroy each other.
Yes.
In a way, like those are very relatable feelings. So for us to still be on board with that and able and well-equipped enough to feel those things at the mm-hmm. end is a marker of a really talented writer.
Yes. And a lot about this movie, a huge message of this movie is like your ambition sort of like eating you alive. Mm-hmm. Like your ambition taking you so far as to destroying you. And I think that Aaron Sorkin does it so brilliantly in the social network because he takes you to the edge of the cliff sometimes. Like he'll say, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is going to face these consequences, and then takes you away from that and says, no, yeah. not yet. Right. Yeah. Like he says like not you. Yet. I know he fakes you the fuck out a lot because he's in the real world. People don't face these kinds of consequences no. all the time. Right. And it's how he keeps his characters morally ambiguous mm-hmm. because he's like, they don't always fail. They don't always falter. They may make a mistake and yeah. that doesn't always lead to a consequence.
Yeah.
And so you as the audience member are sitting there being like, okay, he didn't get in trouble for this. So are we cool? Question mark. And yeah. then he gets in trouble for something else. And he loses things that matter most to him in different ways.
Yeah.
So he fails in very, very different ways. And I think Aaron Sorkin does an incredible job of letting that like flower throughout the film and faking you out as the audience member mm-hmm. and saying, no, he's not going to get this consequence, but he is going to lose this relationship.
Yeah, exactly. There you're just pulled in so many directions by this movie. Like, and a lot of it comes down to the actors as well. Like mm-hmm. this movie was a huge fucking springboard for everyone in it.
Oh God.
Like
yeah.
Jesse Eisenberg, Andrew Garfield, nobody knew who Armie Hammer was when he was in this movie. No. And he plays two people. He plays twins.
Yeah. The dialogue in this movie is very verbose. So it's just, it kind of really like brings you in to what I like to call like how a god would talk.
Yeah.
Sure. And not really like real people. And as long as you get over yourself, like as long as you get over that, like no one's gonna say dating you is like dating a Stairmaster. Like no one says that.
No, but that's something you wish you said when yes. you left the conversation.
So exactly. So in Aaron Sorkin film, the way that this specific movie goes is they all say things that you wish that you thought of in the car on your way home from arguing with that person.
Yeah. Like the fucking scene, you know, the scene mm-hmm, when mm-hmm. Andrew Garfield storms into Facebook and he gets pulled to the side and told that his share had been.
Well, no. First, Sean Parker's like, excuse me, Mark is plugged in right now.
But first he walked in and he got pulled away and was informed that yes. his shares had been dissolved.
Yes.
And then you see they do that wide shot and you yes. see him in the very back and you see him realize like, what's happening.
And he just explodes.
And then he stomps forward and he yes. has that fucking line where he breaks the laptop.
Yes.
And he's like, I must have forgotten my like Prada backpack and my fucking yeah. flip-flop.
Yeah. This is shit that you wish that you would have said,
which is why it's so satisfying.
You're like, yes, bitch.
Yeah,
eat them up.
Kill him.
Don't leave a single crumb, bitch.
Eat the rich.
Eat it up. Oh, it's so good.
It's so fucking good. I mean, I could go on for days about The Social Network. It's just a really fucking incredible
honestly,
movie.
Like at the end of the day, people watch movies because they bring them joy or, mm-hmm. or they provide entertainment value. This is strictly entertainment. Like yeah. this tells a very compelling story, but also like it's very dramatic and it's very like,
yeah, and I mean it's kind of depressing when you realize like, okay, Mark Zuckerberg has all this fucking money, but he's nobody alone. Likes him.
Exactly.
He's fucking lonely.
Exactly. So it's a great film. Go watch it. It has 10 out of 10 squids for us.
Yes.
We love it.
We love it. Moving on.
Perfect segue into the next giant who has fallen mm-hmm. in a different way than originally intended. Molly's Game, which is his very first directorial effort.
Mm-hmm.
And Jessica and I will get into him as a director in a moment.
Yeah, but this is an interesting episode because it's the first time Monica and I are talking about things that we don't necessarily love. I mean, other than when we talked about The Mummy on the Brendan Fraser episode. Oh my God.
But we found incredible things to say about that.
I mean, we made it like fun, but I think this episode we do have like a lot of different opinions.
Yeah.
On things.
Absolutely.
You know, which I think is interesting.
I think it's fun.
I think it's fun.
Tell us about the movie, Monica.
Molly's Game came out in 2017. Great year. Great year for Molly's Game. Written and directed by Aaron Sorkin, based on the book by Molly Bloom. Mm-hmm. The true story of Molly Bloom, played by Jessica Chastain, a beautiful young ex-Olympic class skier who ran the world's most exclusive high-stakes poker game for a decade before being arrested in the middle of the night by the FBI fucking eye. Her players included Hollywood royalty,
Tobey Maguire.
Sports stars, business titans, and finally, unbeknownst to her, the Russian fucking mob.
Yeah, Jesus Christ.
Her only ally was a criminal defense lawyer, Charlie Jaffe, played stunningly by Idris Elba.
Idris Elba.
Who learned there was much more to Molly than the tabloids led people to believe.
Yes, yes, yes.
Wow. Okay, first things first. The screenplay is glorious.
Beautiful screenplay.
Jessica Chastain.
I have met people who didn't like Molly's Game, but I really liked it. I thought it was great.
Molly's Game. Yeah, a lot. I would say it wasn't necessarily a divisive film. Like, I wouldn't say half the people loved it and half the people hated it.
No.
I would say, like, 60 or 70% of the people liked it, and then, like, 30% of the people did not
like it.
We're like,
it was fine.
Yeah, it was like, oh, it was fine. So, specifically, the screenplay of the film, it's so fun and original. I've never, ever... I don't know anything about poker. I didn't know that it could be this... like insane and dramatic and crazy.
Yeah.
And I love that he brought that to my attention, as he always does. My boy Aaron Sorkin. My close personal friend Aaron Sorkin. And I thought that the choice to cast Jessica Chastain as Molly was absolutely inspired. Like, she is the perfect level of, like, direct and like level-headed and also like deeply scared, mm-hmm. and like she was just so fucking good in this film, and I think Idris Elba, like, oh my god, he has the best, in my opinion, the best monologue in this film. It's so fucking good. But specifically with Aaron Sorkin's writing in this film, mm-hmm. we love his directing on
No, it leaves something to be desired. I will say, okay, so about his writing, I like this movie a lot. I did feel at times that he got into some territory where it felt more like Aaron Sorkin talking than Aaron Sorkin writing a character.
Yes.
Because, like, these are real people. In The Social Network, the writing was very varied from character to character because they're based on real people and you have to talk the way that the real people talk. In this one, that was mostly still there, but there were moments where Molly was speaking and I was like, is this actually how she fucking talks?
Probably not. Not just that, the movie had pacing issues,
mm-hmm.
Specifically around the middle to the end. So almost the whole movie. it had pretty significant pacing issues.
Yeah.
It left a lot to be desired directing-wise. I think that he got... just, you don't have to tell Jessica Chastain what to do. Like, that's just not something that you have to do. And you don't have to tell Idris fucking Elba what to do. That's not something you have to do.
Yeah.
I just think there was so much, and I hate to say it, there was so much about this film that I was like, I think he's trying to be David Fincher, and I don't really appreciate it.
Well, so, I don't know if you read this, but when he decided to direct the movie, he was like, I don't know what to do, and called David Fincher asking what to do. So it makes perfect sense that that's why it looks that way. The thing is, it's very hard for me to articulate like exactly how I feel about Aaron Sorkin as a director, because like I don't like him as a director.
No.
But the movie got made and it was a relatively good movie, and so therefore you have to go, well, he did something. But
he got made.
He got good performances out of his actors. He told an interesting story, but I don't think there was anything special about it. I can't point to something in terms of direction and go, that's Aaron Sorkin.
No, and I think that's the biggest issue that I have with his directing, and we'll talk about it a lot more when we dive into a little, like,
we have a bonus moment
bit about Trials of Chicago 7. But he doesn't have a directing style.
No.
And that bothers me to no end.
Because, like, he has such a distinct writing style.
Exactly. He has such a distinct voice. So you think, like, oh, this will translate so well into his directing style. Like it's not going to be like a David Fincher film. It's going to be more like in your face, kind of a little bit less stylized, and just a little bit more like snappy. That's what I imagined his directing style to be.
Yeah.
And that was nothing like what Molly's Game or Trials of Chicago 7 ended up being, because I think it's literally just like, not the carbon copy, but like the yellow one underneath the carbon copy.
Sure.
Version of like the David Fincher film that I don't appreciate.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're exactly correct. I do think that it takes a talented filmmaker / writer to keep me invested in interesting things that I don't give a shit about, aka poker.
I don't give a shit about poker either.
Aaron Sorkin, I said it previously, he likes to write about things that a lot of people don't give a shit about or know anything about. I mean, plenty of people who know about poker watch this movie, and plenty of people know about poker. I don't. And there's a lot of technical poker shit in this movie. And yet I was like, I'm right there with you. I'm following along. I don't know what any of it means, but the stakes are still made clear to me.
Absolutely.
Which does take a talented writer to convey those things and to keep your audience engaged when they might be fucking zoning out because the only thing on the screen is a graphic of cards flipping over.
Yes, I'm like, what? I felt like I was watching like a video game when that was happening. I was like, I don't get it, but I understand that it's supposed to be important because it's on the screen.
Yeah. I also like how he wrote like the player X character.
That was great.
In this, which I know obviously Molly Bloom is somewhat responsible for that because this movie is based on the book. And in the book, she combines everyone into a player X kind of thing. Player X is supposed to be like a combination of a number of celebrity poker participants. Mainly Tobey Maguire, which is probably why he has no career anymore.
Maybe.
This movie came out in 2017, and very conveniently, the last good thing he did was in 2017. So. Anyway, so Michael Cera plays Player X, and he's so fucking good in it. He's kind of like scary. I never thought I would see Michael Cera as scary,
and I love Michael Cera. He is one of my. Like, he's one of my favorite comedic actors. Mm-hmm. Like, he's so good. And it was so incredible to see him shift into something so, like he played like a big bad boy. You know what I mean? With big bad boy pants. And like, I'm a big bad boy with a lot of money and I got a lot of power. And fuck all of y'all.
Yeah.
And he was scary. And I've never seen Michael Cera do that.
Neither.
He's always like a little, no offense, but he always plays like a little bitch. Like,
yeah, like a little quiet bitch boy.
But no, he was a big boy in this movie.
He was not a bitch boy in this movie. He was not a
bitch boy.
He was real scary. And I mean, he scared Molly. Which is saying something because she's a tough bitch.
Jessica Chastain. it was just so just the storytelling was great. Like the story itself, the plot of Molly's Game is incredible. I think
and understanding like what is at risk.
It's so unique, and it sort of brings back the whole like she was doing something low-key shady, but you're still rooting for her.
Yeah, like she was doing everything legally until one moment of racketeering.
It was
right?
it was like she was doing everything great until she wasn't.
Yeah. And then the government took like way more than what was owed to them because a lot of what she did was legal. Understanding the legalities of everything going on was a little complicated, I will admit that. How is it legal to run a gambling ring? I don't really understand, but it technically was because all of your employees were on the books and you filed taxes and blah, 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 blah. It's just, I'm not familiar with that, so that part was kind of difficult to understand. But
I needed to look it up just because I needed to refresh my memory. It reminded me, I was like, what the fuck is that movie by Adam McKay called? It reminded me a lot about how, like, The Big Short gives information.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where it was just, it, like, presented it to you in a really direct way.
Yes. Done with a lot of voiceover.
And you're sitting there as the audience member, like, I understand the basic premise of this, but you're not going to get me to understand, like, the details.
No, understanding how the housing bubble burst in 2000, whatever the fuck year it was. Very, very difficult to understand.
2008?
Yep, that's the one. I couldn't remember. So I will say Molly's Game as like an ending note. Very good. Jessica Chastain is very, very, very good in this movie. It's also like a really well shot movie.
It's beautiful. It's a gorgeous film.
There are some really lovely shots, like when she's driving down the highway in North Hollywood, I think she's in, some shit. And she like has to stop and get out of the car because she's pissed. And she's in her sparkly dress and she's leaning on her car. And then they do that nice wide shot of her leaning on the car. It's really beautiful. Nice.
Lots of reflections happening there. Sort of my last like thought about this film. Mm-hmm. I love Jessica Chastain. She has a lot of power as an actress. And she brings a good amount of like feminine energy to the film.
Sure.
I think that a lot of the film feels very masculine and feels very like mansplainy, even though the words are coming out of her mouth.
Yeah.
which makes me feel kind of sad because usually Aaron Sorkin's pretty good about writing female characters. I think that a lot of it had to do with the directing.
Yeah. The thing is, it's like, I just don't know. I don't know what Molly Bloom is like as a person. I haven't read her book. I don't know what that is like. I assume based off of events in the movie, she was talked down to so much by men that maybe she has just adopted this style of speaking. I don't know exactly.
I guess one of my biggest like problems with it is the fact that it feels very like mansplaining, especially the I wouldn't call it like the climax of the film, but one of the, because this film has many multiple like, climaxes. But one of the climaxes of the film is when Jessica Chastain as Molly Bloom is sitting in like outside of the skating rink and she's like talking to her father, who is a therapist played by
Kevin Costner.
And he's like explaining to her why she feels the way that she does. And he's like, okay, I'm going to give you like 12 years of therapy or however long it was
in two minutes.
And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Comes back to Aaron Sorkin's thing of him constantly needing to tell you where you are and what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
Rather than just saying it in like a smarter way. Sometimes he does it super well, like in The Social Network. Sometimes he does it really poorly, like in Molly's Game. Where you're like, you could have just said that differently in a way more like real nuanced way.
It was very kind of, it was viciously masculine in the way that it gave you the information.
Yeah.
And he was almost talking down to her, which I honestly truly believe in my heart that wasn't the intention. Sure. I don't think it was the intention of the director and also the screenwriter to make it seem like he was talking down to her. But that's what happened.
Well, especially because that's the scene where they like quote unquote reconcile.
Which is, you know what's so funny is you know that it wasn't a good scene because you don't feel like they reconciled. You're like,
wait, do you hate each other?
Because like everything he just said, like this bastard, like you're not gonna have a happy relationship with him.
Yeah.
So they're all in all, there's a lot wrong with this movie and there's a lot right. And I think that it falls somewhere in the middle where I loved this movie, but not in the same way that I loved The Social Network.
No.
Or the one episode of The West Wing that I saw.
Honestly, I think Aaron Sorkin's writing lends itself really well to television.
Yeah, it's lengthy, baby.
I think he gets to do everything he wants without being constricted by a time, by time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Or like a really long play.
Yeah. So usually we only do three movies. We're not technically doing a full fourth, but we're going to give you a little snip of a fourth just because we have a lot of thoughts.
We have so many thoughts. So we had to because it was just so recent. Mm-hmm. Aaron Sorkin very recently released a movie on Netflix called The Trial of the Chicago 7.
Yes.
Based on, you guessed it, The Trial of the Chicago 7.
Yeah, go figure. So I'll give you a quick synopsis of the movie.
Please do.
So it's the story of seven people on trial stemming from various charges, mostly conspiracy charges, surrounding the uprising at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Illinois. It was a lot of people protesting the war, protesting the Democratic nomination in general. There was a lot of fucking shit going on crammed into just under 2.5 hours.
Just about, yeah.
a story that has already been told multiple times via documentary done by HBO. There have been movies done individually about all of the people who make up the Seven. There is a movie coming out with Lakeith Stanfield about it's the head of the Black Panthers. The movie is called Judas and the Black Messiah. I'm much more excited about this movie coming
out. Much more excited
because
about that
it
movie.
Tells the story that I think is more important. It's about Fred Hampton and William O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
So that story is told in like asides.
Yes, that story is much more intriguing to me as a package, right?
Yeah.
My personal biggest issue with Trials of Chicago 7 is it feels very manufactured. It feels like someone took all the, like, okay, Aaron, this is what I imagine happened. This is not what happened. This is what I imagine happened. Aaron Sorkin is in his basement.
Yeah.
Okay? And he has a bunch of different pictures with numbers on them. And he goes, this is the story of the Trials of Chicago 7. And he has a wall that's magnetic, and he has little orange magnets, and he goes, how can I make this a story?
Yeah.
And he takes each one of the pictures with the numbers and puts them in different orders and then goes, this is my movie, and that's it.
Yeah. So this one was directed and written by Aaron Sorkin, and unfortunately I don't think this one was written well either.
Oh.
It felt very disingenuous. It was so scattered. Like, and the thing is this movie got incredible reviews.
Yes.
And I don't get it. I think it has a little bit to do with because it feels very topical and very relevant.
It's very of the time.
I think a lot of people are only seeing its relevance and going, oh, it's a great movie because it's relevant. But on a technical level, this is not a great movie.
Not at all.
I
mean, okay. We're being very harsh because it's Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
So yeah, the movie as a whole is a good movie. Like, it is a good movie in, by itself, right? In its own vacuum world.
I mean,
like,
I don't agree.
Right.
So we will disagree.
Which is totally fine. I think the movie by itself, directed by some other guy, written by some other guy.
Sure.
Like, it stands alone. I think it's very topical, and it definitely made me very emotional. It was very like, it needed to come out right now, and it definitely had a lot to say, but a lot of it had to do with the actual like history of the Trial of the Chicago 7. So a lot of what it had to say was real and wasn't necessarily like dramatized or manufactured. And all those parts, the real parts, I really enjoyed. And I think being an Aaron Sorkin film, it's kind of, this is going to sound really harsh, it's kind of unacceptable that it wasn't like perfection, because he had Molly's Game to test it out, and he should have learned.
Well, they wanted someone else to direct it. Steven Spielberg was supposed to direct this
movie.
What
the fuck?
And they've been passing this around for like 10 years, and then all of a sudden he was just like, I guess I'll just do it. And then it got made. And that's how the movie feels. It feels like a bunch of people said, okay, I guess we'll just make it now because it's been passed around for so long. It's like, I understand what they were trying to do with this movie. I understand that they were trying to, you know, let the story reveal itself in testimony. But that's not what Aaron Sorkin fucking does. He gives you every single distinct piece of information when you need it. And he decided to take his formula that works pretty well and say, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to slowly reveal things to an audience when we, the audience, have not been given enough context for fucking anything. The movie, like, the action of the movie starts and you're literally going, what is happening?
You know what? It feels very theatrical in that way. It feels like very, I think it's exciting to a detriment. Like, it's very theatrical and I just think that the movie as a whole, like, I think it has a big problem with it, the way it was directed. I think that the screenplay was pretty tight given like the subject matter and like what it was, and what, like, if you measure like the success rate of like what it was supposed to do, I think it was a pretty tight screenplay. They just need to stop letting Aaron Sorkin direct his own films, period.
Yes.
because we also agree about the performances. I think that the performances themselves, like as an ensemble cast, I think they all had very unique perspectives and they all gave very unique performances that I loved.
I feel that way about some of them. I mean, like, I think Eddie Redmayne and Jeremy Strong carried this fucking movie on its back. And I think 3/4 of the way through the movie, they realized, oh, fuck, this isn't interesting. Let's hire Michael Keaton to play a character who hasn't been in the first 90 minutes. And have him give some gravitas to this story that it deserves.
Jessica, I was like, this is how it happened. They called up Michael Keaton. They were like, hey, Michael, baby, Michael, you want to be in this new big shot Netflix movie, Trial of the Chicago 7? It's an Aaron Sorkin film, baby. It's going to be big, big, big. And Michael goes, yeah. And they go, but you're only in the last like 20 minutes.
It's just really confusing to me. And everyone's praising Sacha Baron Cohen's performance. And honestly, I just don't see it. His accent is bad. His performance is masturbatory. Like, I don't like it. It's like Sacha Baron Cohen being like, this is my chance to shine as a real actor. And then making the entire story about him when like, it's not. It's about 8 different people. Even though it's called Trial of the Chicago 7, it is about 8 people.
I totally agree with him making it all about himself. And I eat it up.
See, you're on board for it. I'm like, I don't stand for this. And then Aaron Sorkin took liberties with like real events that happened
in
the fucking movie.
Did.
So like the movie ends, it's supposed to be really inspiring because the defense gets one last chance to like make a statement. And so they all agree that Eddie Redmayne is going to get to make a statement. And the judge is like, the judge has fucking had it. The judge is a fucking asshole.
Well, the judge is a racist asshole.
He's a racist asshole. That aside, he's like, I'm done. You need to make this statement really short or else I'm going to hold you in contempt of court. And Eddie Redmayne's like, cool, I'll make it short. And instead he reads like the 5,000 names of the people who have died in the soldiers who have died in Vietnam since the trial started, because the trial takes like almost an entire year.
Yes.
What we aren't told is that Eddie Redmayne's character is not the fucking person who read those names.
No.
Also, the names weren't just read of soldiers. They were also read of the Vietnamese people who died at the same time. And it was read by someone totally different who in the movie is supposed to be like, he's like the less attractive family man of the group. He's the one who read it in real life, but they gave it the fucking Netflix touch and had like hot Eddie Redmayne
read the
names and be like super noble at the end. I just don't like it.
I know you said that Eddie Redmayne carried the movie on his back. Oh, obviously, along with
in terms Jeremy of his Strong. Acting. Right. I mean,
I fucking hate him. I hate him in this movie. He was my least favorite character in this fucking film. I was like, little bitch, get the fuck out of Chicago. Get out of this township. Get out of town. I don't want you.
He was the only person whose performance I could like get behind. Him and Jeremy Strong, like they're the only people I could get behind. I could not buy Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a prosecuting attorney for a fucking second.
That was, first of all, it was adorable.
It was so cute that you cast Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the American government's prosecuting attorney.
Okay, there's a lot to admire about this film, personally.
For Monica.
The individual, remember how I was like, in the basement, there's Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
He's in his
basement.
Overalls.
We're in the basement.
He's got the orange magnets. Individual, like, I guess like beats of the movie, I love. Like I think it's a triumph in that way. The individual beats of the movie, I'm like, yes, I'm here for it. I think that the end result was a problem with Sorkin as a director. They just need to fucking strap him down and not let him do anything. But I do love the performances. So we've got like 2 different opinions here, which is totally fine. I totally see what you're talking about, by the way. 100%.
You're sitting here and you're like, I love the individual beats. I'm like, that's so nice that you love them because I think it's a fucking horrible movie.
I do think it is, which is totally fine. I do think it is way too manufactured. They should not let, I need a t-shirt that says, my problem is with Sorkin, the director, not Sorkin, the screenwriter.
Yeah. I think in your mind,
you're like, I have a problem with both motherfuckers.
For this movie, because I think Aaron Sorkin was just like, I do not think he understood the scope of the story that he was telling.
Totally.
I don't think he understood that. I liked some moments, like I like some editing moments. I like when they put the raw footage of like the real events, when they mixed it in like with the rioting, etc. I thought that was cool and effective. a lot of the rest of it, I'm just like, why didn't you? You were the king of exposition. You were the king of telling me exactly what the fuck is happening. And you decide in the year of our Lord 2020 to drop me into a courtroom drama where you haven't explained why we're even in the courtroom. I have such a problem
guys,
with that.
Guys, okay. I'm I am team. The Trial of Chicago 7 was good. Was it great? No. Was it bad? Absolutely not. It was good. I think it was a great powerhouse cast. I think it was phenomenal in that way. I think it has problems with... I think the individual beats were great. I think it has problems with it being too manufactured. It didn't feel authentic or as natural as I wanted it to. And I think that Aaron Sorkin should end his career as a director. So I'm that team. Jessica, what team are you?
I'm on the team that this movie is terrible. I just don't see a lot of like merit. Redeemable qualities to this movie. Despite some of the performances and some of the editing, it just feels like it was trying to do too much without paying attention to what needed to be paid attention to. Like, we just threw away storylines that are way more intriguing and way more important, in my opinion.
You know what I want?
Tell me.
I want a stoner comedy starring Jeremy Strong.
Yeah.
And Sacha Baron Cohen.
I'm fucking on board with that.
And Aaron Sorkin does not need to write or direct it.
I think Aaron Sorkin was trying to turn the Trial of Chicago 7 into a stoner comedy starring Jeremy Strong and Sacha Baron Cohen. That's what I think was trying to happen.
Order! Order in this court! Oh my God. Anyway, we really only meant to talk about it for like 2 seconds.
But we got really riled up there.
We got very riled up. Anyway, the point is, just go watch the movie, because if you watch it, at the very least, you can formulate your own opinion and you can decide what team you're on.
Yeah, that's the only reason why you should watch it. Besides that, I'd say don't waste your
time. Oh my God.
Sorry, Aaron. I love you, but not in this one.
Aaron Sorkin, stop directing. I'm going to make one of those lists, one of those signature collection lists that's like, hey, baby, stop directing.
All right. Well, so that was Aaron Sorkin. There's a lot of mixed feelings and mixed opinions, but I think that's what he inspires in people in general.
That's the whole point.
Because I know people who fucking hate Aaron Sorkin.
The duality of men.
So Monica, what have you been dabbling in?
I've been dabbling in a lot of, I've been trying to perfect my bird.
Your bird.
My bird.
Your bird is brining.
My bird is currently brining the fridge. And bird meaning chicken, by the way. This episode comes out
post Thanksgiving, but in the real world,
I'm trying to figure out
right now
which bird is best.
Yeah.
So I'm bird watching.
Monica loves bird watching.
I've been dabbling in some bird watching as of late. So there's a spatchcocked guy in the fridge right now.
Fuck yeah.
So, yeah. What about you, Yasika?
I'm trying to get back into baking, man. Ah. I haven't baked something in a long time, and I used to be so, I mean, I say used to, like 3 months ago.
In another time.
Into baking. But, you know, because when I wasn't working during quarantine, it was like that I would do it all the time because I was bored. And now I have a fucking job. So, you know, it's frustrating. But today I'm making a cranberry tart.
Oh!
It'll be very exciting.
I'm excited. I love cranberries. Anyway, this is enough. You guys have heard enough.
You've heard enough from us.
Mouse.
Come out of my mouse.
Come out of my mouse. Rosito.
Oh my God. we don't have a question for this week, right?
No, we don't. It's a question-free week, which means you guys should be asking us questions. We have a form on our website, johnfavorosmydaddy.com. Yes. That is just literally our podcast
or
name.
Or email us at johnfavorosallegedlymydaddy@gmail.com, right? No, or is it just johnfavorosmydaddy@gmail.com
now? No, we haven't made that one yet.
Okay, so it's johnfavorosallegedlymydaddy@gmail.com or DM us at our newest Instagram page.
Oh my God.
JohnFavoroIsMyDaddyPod, because Instagram still hasn't given us our account back.
Which is just insane to me. How long has it been? Like,
too long.
2 weeks?
I've heard it takes months.
Whatever, we'll get it back.
Fucking hope we'll get so, it back. Man.
Thank you guys for
thank you.
I mean, I don't know if it's gonna be the same at this point. I expect that we'll get famous overnight, but we currently have 750 listeners.
Exactly.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for the fame. I won't forget you.
And with that,
don't sue us, Daddy Favreau.
Goodbye, Monica.
Goodbye, Jessica.
And happy birthday, Aaron.
Happy birthday, Aaron. Not Sorkin. Jacob.
Aaron Jacob, our audio man. Thank you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
Thanks.